Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Barry Ritholtz, David Rosenberg, and Ira Harris. Barry is the CIO of Ritholtz Wealth Management, guest commentator on Bloomberg Television, and a blog writer. He's also the host of the Bloomberg podcast Masters in Business. David just recently founded his own firm, Rosenberg Research, after being the chief economist and strategist at Gluskin Sheff. He served as the chief economist for Merrill Lynch and one of the 12 smartest people on Wall Street by Business Insider. And Ira's independent trader, hedge fund manager, and global macro consultant trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also a CME director from 1997 to 2003 and recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for being
here. Great to be here.
Yep, sure is.
Great. I thought we have initial discussion on the Federal Reserve statement this week in terms of the yield curve and what your thoughts on that are, if it was clear or a bit reticent. Barry, do you want to begin?
No, there's few things in life I care less about than Federal Reserve statements.
Okay.
It's not just that they're meaningless. It's a ridiculous distraction about irrelevancies. And I know that this is not a popular opinion, but life is too short to spend a lot of time doing Kremlinology on Fed speak. Now let me let Dave Rosenberg lose his mind. I'm just trying to give him something to chew on.
Okay.
Well, I guess I'll weigh in on my thoughts on the minutes that came out yesterday. I actually thought that they were very interesting because I'm convinced that the stock market starts to roll over right after the minutes came out because – when you read the document, it's so clear that all the macro risks are skewed to the downside. I was particularly surprised at how downbeat the Fed was on business capital spending. But overall, what was interesting was that they view their base case scenario of muddling through with equal odds of the downside scenario, which is that we have a double dip recession. I thought that was very interesting that their downside projection has as much weighting in terms of probability as their base case muddle through scenario. So I was actually taken aback, frankly, by just how somber the economic message was. And yet when you go back to that meeting 6 weeks ago, they didn't do anything, I don't think they believe that they're tapped out, but I'm thinking that the Fed, which had been so aggressive and so proactive back in March and April, that now they're going to be more reactive as opposed to proactive, because even though they seem to have a very somber view of the economic outlook, there was absolutely no sense of urgency to do anything concrete beyond just communication strategy. And in fact, one of the reasons why the bond market sold off was because they backed off this notion that they would do at some point soon the yield curve control strategy, where they would cap rates out the curve like other countries have done, and Japan being a classic example. So it was really an interesting document, only because the Fed seems to have almost downgraded its economic view, and at the same time didn't really offer any policy prescription against that.
And Ira, your thoughts?
Well, I find a lot in commonality with David on this, and yet most times I'm with Barry that I think it's ridiculous, especially though that I've learned that the chair and the secretary can really rework these all the way up to before the release. So if there's things that change, the minutes will reflect not just what took place at the meeting. They hide behind the use of numbers, So I'm with Dave. I thought that the backing off on the yield curve, which I thought set the market, sent the gold lower substantially, the dollar higher. The dollar was already rallying, but I think the fact that they weren't, it was a very dovish press conference in Powell, and yet the minutes did not reflect that as dovish as that was, especially with the yield curve. So I found that very, very interesting. They're so reticent about that, or at least that's the way it came across yesterday. Although, if you know, if I wait for the next Fed speakers to speak, Brainard et al., they'll speak more about the yield curve control aspect. But I did find it interesting for that reason, because of the yield curve control, you know, they walked it back and the market responded. Now, today we got, of course, different types of action. The bonds, which originally sold off, I'm talking about the future, so yields went higher, but not substantially. So not like the previous week on the inflation data when we saw that movement. So I'm with David. I thought it was interesting in the market reaction. And now today, another day, we spent winding yesterday's reaction.
So let me just flesh out what I said earlier and not just be a crank, but explain why my views are what they are. So first of all, this is the minutes of a meeting that took place a month ago. And under lockdown and COVID, a month is might as well be a lifetime, because so much happens and so many things are changing. And I am always on guard for the classic narrative fallacy and hindsight bias that something happens in the world and the market also does something. And we start telling stories that because this happens, the market did that. And most of the time, it's just not an accurate portrayal of how stocks trade intraday. We want to tell a story. We want there to be a cohesive narrative, because in emotionally and intellectually, we hate the concept that things are kind of random and nothing is a true causal relationship that we can wrap our heads around. But why would the gold market today care about July's meetings and the conversation about the yield curve? And I just find the after the fact explanations way convenient. It's certainly nothing that people accurately predict in advance. Well, if the Fed says this about the spread or the yield curve or this or that, here's what the market's going to do. It just feels to me so often when I see this in the media and I read it in commentary, it's and everybody does this. Humans are all guilty of this. It's not anybody on this call. We all want to tell a cohesive story that makes sense, as opposed to saying, well, it's a big, complex, intricate machinery, and it's so random and so complicated that we really don't know exactly why stocks did this. But here's a convenient thing to hang our hats on. And my favorite example of that is in the early days of the Iraq war in March 03, I remember seeing oil prices spike the day U.S. bombers accidentally hit a Iraqi mosque, and the Wall Street Journal headline was, you know, oil spikes as mosque is destroyed, as a, you know, significant mosque is destroyed. By the end of the afternoon, not only had oil prices come back down to where they started, they went deeply negative on the day, and the headline suddenly got changed to oil prices sink despite mosque being destroyed. And it just goes to show you, it's just a classic example of hindsight bias and narrative fallacy. And we really have to be careful when we're attributing causations to, you know, intraday commodity price swings. Talk about random.
Let me, if I could, though, push back a little bit, because I'm certainly not in disagreement with that. But I think you have to separate traders from investors.
Sure.
Especially in the algo world. The algo world is built upon those narratives in play in an instantaneous fashion, which then begets the action that they keep pushing for. So, and a lot of the headlines are crafted, in my opinion, from watching it and trading it, to get the most volatility that they possibly can. Because once you get past those headline pieces, the context of the story has no relationship to what that headline is, but the algos have been set into motion, driving these prices dramatically. And I think that's what we saw. So I agree with Barry's 100% from an investment standpoint, meaningless. From a trader standpoint, has great significance and provides, by the way, great opportunities, which is what the algos are really built for. But if you use the, I consider it like judo. If you use the weight of the algos against them, it will give you absolutely wonderful entry points at low risk if you were looking for other types of trades.
In terms of your thoughts, Barry, on the economy and the financial markets post-COVID, the post-COVID era, for, you know, from the fiscal response by governments, monetary response by central banks, what are your thoughts there and how it has affected the financial markets?
Sure. Well, there's a lot of moving pieces there. And so let me indulge my own narrative fallacy and see if I could tell a story that makes some sense. So lots of people have been talking about the disconnect between the markets and the economy. I have to begin by pointing out that there is very little correlation, at least in real time and even on a lag, between the economy and the markets. Markets usually lead, not always. You look at how much further the markets went up when the housing market was collapsing in 05, 06. And yet, so the one-to-one correlation is rare, number one. Number two, when you look at the big indices, they're market cap weighted, so they're definitely driven to a large degree by the bigger stocks. And one of the things that people seem to forget is how important that weighting is. And I'll give you just two good examples. One is take the FANG stocks in Microsoft. You know, on average, they get half or more of their revenue from overseas. Apple is as much as 60% in any given quarter. Google, Facebook, Microsoft around 50%. Amazon is really the only exception. They're about 35% is overseas. But who is better situated to take advantage of a pandemic lockdown than the logistics last mile people at Amazon, plus the owner of Amazon Web Services? So to some degree, when you're looking at the market, you're not just looking at the U.S. economy. You're looking at the rest of the global economy, which for a long time has lagged the U.S. economy. But since we have done such a bungled job about managing COVID and then bungling our reopening, we've seen the rest of the world handle this better. Now, admittedly, places like New Zealand are seeing a spike in infections. I think they had 9 2 days ago and 7 today. So, you know, it's not perfect everywhere. But when you look at the companies that derive most of their revenue from overseas, clearly, and overseas is doing better than us, clearly that's going to benefit them. And then the second and most important issue to me is the relative small weights of what we see in the real world. So we see gas prices are down and department stores are collapsing and hotels and casinos and things like that are terrible and restaurant chains are doing awful and travel service is awful and go down the whole list. But these are relatively tiny sections of the index. You could take department stores. They're less than 15/100ths of a percent of the S&P 500. In fact, we could take the 30 worst sectors of the S&P 500, delist them, and tomorrow it would barely shave 2% off the top of the index. Do the same for the 50 worst sectors, and it's 6%, almost 6% of the index. So even though the market looks like it's run away and the economy is still much worse than it was at the peak of the financial crisis, it's kind of an unusual situation, and it's not the normal recession. It is a pandemic forced lockdown recession where those companies that are helping people work from home, people work remotely, all these tech companies, they're doing really well. We've seen a rise of homesteading and a rise of people turning their homes into compounds and extended family. There's a shortage of lumber. We're putting in a new deck. I'm still waiting 3 weeks for the Trex artificial lumber to show up. Home Depot, Lowe's, that sector of the economy is doing really well. But that is admittedly a narrow sector. Most of the economy is still, by any measure, horrific. It's just that the economy and the market are two completely different entities.
And David?
Look, it comes back to the very first question that you posed, which was about the Fed. But you asked a very specific question about what happened yesterday with those FOMC minutes. But let's just say that I think we'd have to accept the premise that money matters, and it has to matter. And we actually all work in the money industry. So we can talk all about the different things the Fed has done between interest rates and between the balance sheet expansion. But it all comes down to what is it doing to liquidity and what is it doing to the money supply. Now, historically, money supply growth, and let's just talk about M2. If you're taking a look over 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60-year periods, the growth rate in M2 historically runs on average a percentage point faster than nominal GDP. We have a situation now where the Fed's actions have boosted M2 by more than 20% this year. M1 is running 40%. I mean, these are rates of growth in the money supply that would have made Arthur Burns blush back in the 1970s. So I said before that historically money and nominal GDP grow in tandem. Money grows about a percentage point faster to grease the wheels in the system. But that gap now between money supply growth for this year and nominal GDP growth has soared to an unprecedented 30 percentage points. So money growth in its relation to economic growth is running 30 times faster than the norm. This has never happened before. So what's happening here is that this excess liquidity that's not being absorbed by the real economy is finding a home in the financial economy. And that's why we have excessive valuations in practically every single risk asset class that you could find out there. Now, in terms of the economy, if it wasn't for the monetary and fiscal stimulus that we've seen, we would most definitively right now be in a very deep recession. I'm not saying that we're out of the woods by any stretch, and I think the Fed is quite correct in having a circumspect approach towards the economy, notwithstanding what the markets might be telling you. And the markets really aren't telling you a whole lot about the economic outlook, but they're feeding off the excess liquidity. So we have two powerful forces at work. When I mentioned that M2 and M1 are running between 20 and 40% annual rates of growth, which is unheard of, bigger than anything in the 1970s. What that means in dollar terms is $2.9 trillion this year of incremental liquidity from the monetary side. And then we have Uncle Sam digging into his pocketbook. And on the fiscal side, we have $2.3 trillion of fiscal stimulus, and it's clearly not over. We've redefined what austerity is. When $1 trillion of stimulus today is viewed as being too harsh. Think about that for a second. But we've had year to date $2.9 trillion of monetary stimulus, $2.3 trillion of incremental fiscal stimulus, added up, and it's $5.2 trillion of government support to combat an epic loss of GDP of $2.4 trillion. So you see what I said, $5.2 trillion of medication to deal with $2.4 trillion of lost GDP pain. That's a ratio of 2-to-1 in terms of medication exceeding the pain. So Washington went for broke, practically went broke, and it plowed money into the hands of households at an incredible 146% annual rate so far this year. So when you're taking a look at this situation, wages and salaries this year are actually down 8%. What we've seen in the labor market, well, that was real. And so wages, what you call organic work-based income, that fell 8%. That's a big number. But because of the 146% jump in government transfers, incomes have gone up 12% this year. So that point needs to be emphasized. In the first recession ever, and the deepest recession since the 1930s, personal income, which represents the consumer base, which is 70% of the economy, incomes have gone up 12% this year. No recession has ever seen a flood of government cash a month after a recession started. So I'll pose the question that what if we look back next year and realize that this is the good part of the economic recovery and that the next chapter is that incomes fall when the fiscal stimulus fades and these government programs end. And so it's with that that I think we got to go back and we got to think about the really smart people out there that have their pulse on the economy. And who would have their pulse in the economy better than Jamie Dimon, who traditionally has a big happy face on? And what did he say just a few weeks ago? He said this. He said, the word unprecedented is rarely used properly. This time it's being used properly. It's unprecedented what's going on around the world. And obviously COVID itself is a main attribute. The economy would be in shambles without the safety net of the CARES Act. In a normal recession, unemployment goes up, delinquencies go up, charge-offs go up, home prices go down. None of that is true here. Savings are up, incomes are up, home prices are up. So you will see the effect of this recession. You're just not going to see it right away because of all the stimulus, end quote. And I would fully endorse that sentiment.
Very interesting, especially those numbers. Ira, your thoughts?
Well, so we don't hear enough about it since we saw that savings number jump dramatically with the flush of money into the system, both fiscally and monetarily. So the Fed has actually stopped talking about it of late, too, but I know it had to scare them because we saw the savings rate jump to, what, 32, 33%, which I think is actually a rational response to all the vast amount of uncertainty. So if those start to wind down, and I've seen some of the credit card delinquencies are starting to move back up again, so those are what we'll be watching. Just to get a sense of even with all this money floating into the system, and of course, in the short term to save the economy, yeah, we're back in the 30s and they're doing everything that they can to not make the mistakes. But where does it end and where does it go from here is where we're going to judge this out. And if that savings rate starts to fall, without the employment situation getting better, I think that would be a very important tell as to where we're going to go in the following 6 months.
Yep. So how does this play out then in terms of do we see an initial deflationary spiral? But as David mentions, all of this inflation, asset inflation, lots of stimulus happening, does it morph into stagflation later? And especially given all the supply chain disruption and demand destruction, how does that factor in? Your thoughts, Barry?
So that's kind of an interesting question. I'm somewhat enamored of Jeremy Siegel's thesis that we might see a temporary uptick in inflation, but it's up against a lot of existing deflationary forces, given all the stimulus that's come through and whatever might come through next. I don't know if it's half a trillion, 2 trillion, who knows? And if the polls are right and it's a change election and there's a sweep, well, you can expect even more stimulus in 2021. There's a possibility we see some sort of uptick in inflation, but the battle that's being fought for the past, I don't know, with Japan back to 89, but with us back to the financial post-financial crisis has been deflation. So when we look at a weakening dollar and strengthening commodities and gold, it kind of suggests there's something to the inflationary camp. But for I don't know, since the financial crisis, what is it, 10, 12 years already, people have been calling for more inflation and occasionally hyperinflation, and they haven't seen it. So I have to say we have much more of a deflationary pressure has been the longstanding trend, and we'll have to wait and see if inflation really rears its head.
And David, your thoughts, especially given the numbers you mentioned on the money supply growth, do we see asset inflation morphing into consumer price inflation?
Well, not necessarily, because we had, as Barry had mentioned, we had tremendous monetary accommodation out of the Fed through quantitative easing through most of the last cycle. But you see the offset to the M from the money supply was from the declining V, which is money velocity. So yeah, I'm just going back to the classic Fisherian identity, the quantity theory of money, MV equals PY. And the velocity of money, the turnover rate, has been in a secular decline. And that's why the M's have created the financial asset inflation, but hasn't created the consumer inflation, at least in terms of how it's measured. Now, look, I'll just say that with 100% certainty that we are going to be getting inflation. That much I can tell you. But I have said repeatedly in my work that stagflation is in our future. But you don't want to be crazy early on this call either. And at this stage, I think it's like talking about dessert, you know, while we're still eating the appetizer. And I think it's important to remember, as people talking about really the data that come out, the PPI, CPI month to month, a lot of noise in those numbers. Everybody loves to talk about that. We just got a 0.6% increase in the core CPI. Good Lord. Biggest increase since January of 1991. Who even remembers that? I mean, the real recovery and the next Fed tightening cycle didn't happen for three more years. So I think it's important to remember that inflation and deflation are a process. They are not a data point in time. It's not like pricing trends in a $20 trillion economy like the U.S. just shift on a dime. It takes years. And it's a race between watching grass grow and paint dry. Now, I would say that the increasingly inelastic agri supply curve in the future is going to dominate. And what I'm talking about here are the cost impacts from weaker productivity growth, increased government regulation, something that is definitely going to happen, which is the localization of global supply chains and a depletion in the pool of available workers. All they will do is conspire to have an inflationary impact on the supply side of the economy. And I get that. But, you know, you can't forecast inflation with just one curve. We all know that the supply curve is going to become more sclerotic in the future. But what I'm going to say is you can't forecast any price without supply and without demand. And the Fed talked about this in the minutes yesterday. It's well worth a read. I agree with them on this, that for the here and now, and I'll talk about the here and now being the next 1 to 2 years, and talk about the stagflation being 2 to 3 years and out. So it is out there, but it's not necessarily right around the bend. This detonation on the demand side has left just too far a gap relative to supply to be worried about inflation. I think if you have a view over the next 1 to 2 years, I just frankly find it next to impossible that we're going to get inflation near term when you have the headline unemployment rate at 10.2%. That's at least double any estimate of where full employment is. You know, people talk about, well, look at the price of copper, the price of lumber, the price of energy. Don't forget, a lot of these things are being squeezed on the supply side. It's not really a demand story. It's more a supply story. But the link between commodities and final inflation is actually very weak. It was probably stronger 100 years ago. It's weaker today. The wage process is far greater of an impact, and there's just too much idle labor out there right now. I mean, the broad U6 unemployment rate is 16.5%. You know, you're just not going to squeeze inflation on any sustained basis with this excessive amount of idle capacity, where one in six American adults are either unemployed or underemployed. And then you turn to the industrial unemployment rate, which we call CAPU, and it's 70%, you know, which means that close to one third of the industrial sector is sitting idle. And these operating rates are at least 10 percentage points below the levels that would historically touch off a sustainable inflationary experience. I just find that right now people are getting far too carried away with what's happening in commodities and getting far too carried away by the latest CPI statistics, which just had a lot of noise in them after I gleaned the data. I want to make this point and make it emphatically. When you're talking about supply and demand, two very powerful curves, aggregate supply, aggregate demand. And you can't possibly have an inflation framework without understanding how these two curves, how they're shaped, and what their movement is going to be, and their interaction over time. You have to have a demand and supply framework for anything if you're going to make a forecast for a price. So when you're taking a look at what economists call the output gap, which is the differential between aggregate supply and aggregate demand expressed as a share of GDP, I know it sounds like a very arcane economic concept, but if you don't have a view as to what the output gap is, and it's really the measure of excess supply in the product and labor markets, if you don't have a view as to what that looks like, you can't possibly have an inflation forecast. You can have a narrative. You can talk about your views at cocktail parties, but you do have to have a rigorous framework. Well, the Congressional Budget Office, nonpartisan, actually estimates that today this output gap is 8%. It's more than double what it was at the worst point of the 2008-09 Great Recession. The output gap is 8%, and they don't even think it's going to be below 6% by the end of this year. And the CBO sees that this output gap is going to be 3.5% by the end of next year. And 3.5% by the end of next year, well, that's basically about the level we had in the worst part of 2008-09. So all I have to know to form an opinion on the staying power of any inflation, at least over the next 18 months, is actually pretty minimal. I'm not going to say that the CBO has the market cornered on this estimate of the output gap, but I would say that their estimate is probably as good as anybody else. So I'll just say that I'll worry about inflation or stagflation after that. What I'm telling you and the listeners is that there's no theoretical or even practical construct that leads you to an inflation conclusion with the amount of excess supply that is destined to linger into the end of next year and maybe even beyond that.
Mm-hmm. And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, the role of the dollar plays to me a significant place because I start my analysis always from the global macro standpoint. So I look at this dollar, and we've seen the dollar. You know, people talk about the great movement, and I think the movement. I think Barry Eichengreen actually wrote an article yesterday, had it dead right. It's sensationalized, and it really is not that significant. If you take the high that the dollar made in March, April. Yeah, it's 11%. But if you use year-ending numbers and smooth it over more, maybe it's 3 or 4%, and that's against the euro. So it really hasn't been significant yet. But I think it's important because driving some commodity prices higher for the emerging market world is a positive force for the world. The dollar shortage, I think the Fed, it's really one of the areas that I think the Fed handled very well, jumping in with the swap lines and then opening them to banks that they hadn't previously had them for. And now I saw the ECB this morning said that they're going to provide facilitation for one day a week, down from 3 days a week. So there's no longer a pressing, and I stress that word, a pressing shortage of dollars in the world. And everybody says, oh, the dollars come off. And then they say, well, the dollar shouldn't come off because Europe is in not great shape. But all these same arguments take place as David just laid out in 07, 08, 09. And yet we got the dollar. I think the euro went up to, you know, 140, 150, 160 with all the same things in place, except that the U.S. was the aggressive, was the first one really aggressively pushing QE, you know, leave out the BOJ for the argument for the moment. So our, and I think it would help the world situation. You know, everybody wants to equate the dollar with trade, but I don't think that this is a trade issue whatsoever. This is a finance issue. So when Trump opens up his mouth and all of a sudden pivots, as Powell pivoted in January 2019, Trump in May pivoted and talked about a strong dollar. I figured Navarro must have set him up and told him that it hurts China, so he must have been in favor of it. But it's not what the world needs when you're struggling through some financial. This started as an economic issue, but of course, as things bleed out, it became a financial issue. And we need that. And the world needed a weak dollar. The Chinese are pushing hard, as we see Yi Gang and an editorial about, or an op-ed piece, I should say, pushing for the IMF to print more SDRs. Of course, that plays to China now that they're in the SDR basket, and they're trying to create more global demand for yuan to make them, at some point, it'll be far into the future to challenge the United States stature as a reserve currency. But I think that's an important discussion in the inflationary impact, because that just will set raw material prices. And in fact, when I look at the way that I'm going to trade equities, I'm thinking that the Fed being successful again, and I'll say it, is that, you know, I'm buying mining, high quality mining, not necessarily gold mining, but mining companies and ag companies that have been the most unloved companies. But if food prices start to move up and the other raw material prices move up, they should do very well. And of course, you know, I only buy companies who have their debt under control and aren't looking to spend like the proverbial drunken sailor. So those are the things I'm looking at, because I think that they will be successful in moving raw material prices higher around the world.
And what about, Barry, your thoughts on MMT, modern monetary theory inspired infrastructure spending? Do you see that coming in Europe and North America?
Well, let's start with the opposite of MMT, which is the Austerians' approach to deficit spending. And I think after having spent the past half century listening to the bullshit from the deficits cause inflation, and if we don't have a balanced budget, we're going to have hyperinflation and the dollar will be debased and no one will lend money to the U.S. Treasury. Since that school of thought has proven itself to be completely worthless, and I have a bit of a background in physics, so I look at a lot of parts of economic theory as, well, if you posit that if you do X, Y will happen, and you do X continuously and Y never happens, then your underlying theory is false and needs to be discarded, and you have to start over with something else. So let's all agree that the bond vigilantes and the deficit faux hawks and the Austerians have no idea what the hell they're talking about, because everything they forecast has not come to pass. Now, the flip side of that is, hey, print unlimited money and there's no negative consequences and we could, you know, deficit spend as far as the eye can see. I find that a little difficult to wrap my head around. Also, there is no free lunch. There are consequences to recklessness and endless deficit spending. But somewhere between those two extremes, free money for everybody and, oh no, deficits will be the end of us, is a more rational, balanced approach that says something like, well, if we deficit spend and do so in a way that is responsible, hypothetically, we write 100-year bonds in order to fund long-term infrastructure projects and that will last 100 years. I mean, there's no reason to use short-term funding for things that'll last decades and decades. So I'm not fully convinced that MMT is the magic elixir that people are hoping for it. But at the very least, it should make us seriously rethink the panic over deficit spending that has my entire adult life has been, going back to Reagan, And forward, all we've heard is how terrible deficits were, and then people proceed to deficit spend. And so far, the consequences have not been bad. And you know, there's always Japan out there at 224% GDP to debt ratio that seems to be not having an inflation problem, but contrarily having a deflation problem. So I don't want to see us just open the printing presses and spend endlessly as if there's no consequence to it. But there has been consequences to being afraid to, for example, raise the gas tax. The consequence is America has the shittiest roads in the developed world, and it's a national embarrassment. Anytime you take any sort of car out with someone from Europe or Asia, they're like, what happened? You guys used to lead the world in infrastructure. How did this run so off the rails? And the answer is an ideology took root that doesn't understand the value of investing in your own country and instead looks at every tax as the path to ruin. But I don't want to digress too far from MMT. The bottom line is, I think we need to approach deficits much more intelligently than either end of the ideological spectrum has, and more intelligently than we have as a nation.
Interesting. And your thoughts, David, for MMT-inspired infrastructure spending?
Well, you know, I guess the question I'll throw back to you is, why would it have to be MMT-inspired? Unless we couldn't finance it in the public debt markets. The question I would ask is, what does infrastructure spending have to do with financing it on the central bank balance sheet? Why is that necessary? Why is it even desirable? Did President Obama, when he unveiled his $800 billion recovery and reinvestment plan in 2010. Did he come out and say, well, we're going to finance this on the central bank balance sheet? So why do we bring up these ideas or these theories? We do need infrastructure spending in this economy. Why does it have to be financed on the Fed balance sheet? Why would you want to jeopardize the sanctity of the world's reserve currency by doing that? You can't just do debt monetization on your own. Every other country would have to do it because it will mean a further dramatic increase in the money supply, and the weak U.S. dollar that Ira is talking about would turn into a collapse. So it's nice in theory, but it has to be relative. The only reason why the U.S. dollar hasn't gone down even more is that every other central bank is pretty well playing the same game. It's just that the Fed is playing the game a lot more aggressively this year than a lot of other central banks are. So let's just call it for what it is. Mm-hmm. We have a cycle where the government ordered people not to work and ordered people not to shop. We've never had a lockdown before. At least in the Great Depression of the 1930s, FDR put people to work. In this depression, the government told you that you can't work and you can't shop. And we've never lived through anything like this before. And so, you know, it's interesting because everybody thinks that it was World War II that got us out of the Great Depression, but it was because of the New Deal. And the New Deal paid people to work. Of course, back then we had a labor force that knew how to make things with their hands and knew how to build. And that spending had a big productivity payback. I mean, we built the Lincoln Tunnel, the Hoover Dam, the Golden Gate Bridge, Route 66, all the massive waterwork projects in Michigan and northern Pennsylvania, good old-fashioned infrastructure. Well, I would pose the question back to you, you know, they did the infrastructure. They didn't say, oh, well, we need to jeopardize the sanctity of the central bank balance sheet to achieve that. So I just asked the question, yes, we need infrastructure, but what's that got to do with MMT? So I would just say that at some point, we have to stop a fiscal stimulus that turns into a gigantic welfare program or a program that ultimately just ends up creating, again, a sclerotic labor market. Right now, part of the problem is that the government is paying people more not to work than the job they had previously for two-thirds of the population, which is rather incredible. Two-thirds of the people that were laid off are getting paid more through the variety of unemployment benefits and pandemic benefits. But that's basically a result of the collective guilt and remorse by public policymakers telling people that you can't work in the so-called non-essential economy. We ended up finding out that three-quarters of the U.S. GDP is non-essential. That's interesting in its own right. So I'm not a big believer in this MMT unless you think that we can't somehow finance it in the public markets, and maybe we can't. And look, the reality is that it's a moot point anyways, because although the Fed and the government would never tell you that there's no MMT, if you want to just take MMT and just say it's a nice acronym, but it actually means debt monetization, well, we're already seeing it, right? We're already seeing it. It's just that the Fed is not buying the bonds directly from the government. We're still having these auctions, which maybe are a bit of a facade, because then the Fed comes in and buys these securities in the secondary market almost right away. So it's no mere coincidence that the deficit is up $3 trillion this year, and the Fed's balance sheet has expanded $3 trillion this year. That's not just pure happenstance. So the so-called MMT, or what's really called debt monetization, is actually already starting, and maybe it'll continue. You know, that's a political question. But if you're going to ask me, do we actually need infrastructure? The answer is absolutely we need infrastructure. And the beautiful thing about infrastructure is that if we have a labor force that's skilled enough to know how to embark on the infrastructure, it will have a very important productivity payback. You know, this is what we call the fiscal stimulus, and I'm guilty of it too. It's not stimulus. What we're seeing is not stimulus. It's an income transfer. It's not generating a future productivity payback. You know, what people don't realize, and you know, you speak to people and they think FDR was some wacko socialist. Well, I got news for you. The deficit in the 1930s never got above 7.5% of GDP, not in any year. Not in any year did the deficit get above 7.5% of GDP, and already we're talking 20% for this year. The debt ratio under FDR's New Deal, which is infrastructure, guess what? Despite all that spending, the debt ratio never got above 40%. Today, it's heading above 100%. And a good part of that wasn't just because we did have higher taxes. Taxes were not a dirty five-letter word back in the 1930s. But also because the infrastructure generated a rate of return payback that helped pay for it. So, by the way, by 1937, people don't know this, the federal government in the United States, in the context of the Great Depression, 1937, the U.S. government was back into a balanced budget position. How do you like that?
Well, that's great points. Yeah, it makes sense. Your thoughts, Ira?
Yeah, no, I think David's point is very well taken. This is all about income or wealth income transference right now, or wealth transference going on. And, before the result of COVID, I know that we had this discussion, David and I and Peter Buchvar, and we discussed, and then unemployment was 3.5%. And David wisely said that you can't find the workers to do infrastructure projects. Now that we're in a situation where we have nothing but workers, we have no infrastructure plans, which is, to me, this is a pox on all of them. How do they have nothing? Nothing. I mean, and I've done a lot of driving. And when Barry talks about the roads, I just spent 27 hours driving from Scottsdale to Chicago. And then two weeks ago, I drove from Chicago to New York, straight through back. So I've seen a lot of the roads. I've seen a lot of what's going on. This country needs massive infrastructure spending, and we've got nothing, but we'll do a lot of, as David rightly says, income transference. My problem with MMT, and I think that many people on the left should be very nervous about it. I've read it a few times from Warren Mosler's proposals to Stephanie Kelton. Look, I'm an anti-defense spending guy from day one. I understand the necessity of it, but it's one of the greatest frauds perpetrated upon the American public, because everything in the budget process, I'll push back it a little bit, falls apart because everybody becomes a defense spender. And once you become a defense spender, then it's just all politics negotiating for every type of discretionary spending program you may want. So that's why it runs out of control. But if when you go to MMT in its theoretical base, you're back to Lyndon Johnson, guns and butter. You can fight wars to your heart's content because you'll never run out of money. And one of the things throughout history that was beneficial to prevent wars or curtail wars was that monarchies to all types of authoritarian governments ran out of money. Listen, the Soviet Union ran out of money. And it's not because of Reagan's military spending, by the way. I think that's a myth. But they were trying to prop up, of course, Eastern Europe. And once oil prices started to go up, it became very expensive for the Soviet Union to sustain their empire. It became near impossible. So I'm an anti-defense spending person, and for MMT, there is no limit to it. It irritates me now without MMT that one of, to me, Obama's major mistakes was walking away from the Bull-Simpson situation, which started by curtailing defense spending. And I thought he should have really embraced it. And when you had a guy like Alan Simpson, who was, his first words were, let's cut the defense budget by 10%. I was automatically willing to sign. I said, okay, that's a great beginning, because that's how you're going to attack the budget. But where will this go? I don't know. But for all the things that we talk about, and you still have to answer for it, and is that gold prices, come hell or high water, have continued to rise in the face of rising equity prices. And now it's even seemed to have caught the attention of one of the most anti-gold people in the world over this last weekend, which is Warren Buffett, who has now woken up to the fact that the negative real yields do things don't necessarily bear out the way you think in the world of negative real yields, and actually turned that he's buying a high quality miner, Barrick Gold. But these are things that I pay attention to, because when somebody who's, you know, made a who's been a long standing opponent, there are things that are going on in the monetary financing world that are really pushing people away from productive resources and trying to just sustain their underlying value.
Great. And just final question on where would investors in put their money and any trading suggestions on in a general sense, Barry?
So I'm before I give you that answer, I was reading about Buffett over the weekend, and it looks like, or maybe it was earlier in the week, my sense of time under lockdown has completely atrophied. But it was a relatively small purchase of a relatively small junior miner, and it smells more like one of his portfolio managers than Buffett doing a 180 and suddenly backing up the truck on bullion. Although, who knows? You know, 2020 has warned us that anything that can happen probably will. So never say never. So I look at what's going on in the market now and since the sell-off and recovery began as really looking past 2020 and perhaps even past 2021. And we should expect a whole lot of volatility over the next couple of quarters. And if someone says, I have money I want to put in the market, but I need it back at the end of this year, what should I do? I would tell them, keep your money in your pocket, because who the hell knows what's going to happen. We're fully invested. We're bullish. We're long. We have no idea how and when this ends. I did have a really interesting discussion towards the end of March that this wasn't a normal economic cycle where the contraction was caused by something from within the financial world or within the economy. This was an externality. And the world, the markets react to externalities very differently than the way they react to normal cyclical, either a balance sheet recession or a circumstance where the Fed is over tightening and the economy begins to slow. This is, you know, the meteor that killed the dinosaurs and gave rise to the faster, more adaptable, smaller mammals. So it's very challenging to look out and say, here's what the next 6 months to a year might bring. But let me just leave you with this one thought. Maybe the pandemic and the lockdown did not end the bull market that began in 2013. And P.S., we don't date bull markets from their bear market lows in like 2009. The 1982 to 2000 bull market didn't begin at the bear market low of 73. It began when we made new highs in 1982. And this market began when we made new highs in 2013. But hold that aside. Hold that technical definition aside. Maybe the pandemic and lockdown was just a temporary disruption of the secular bull market that began 7 years ago, similarly to way 1987 was a temporary disruption of the bull market that began in 82 and went to 2000. We could really just be in year seven of this bull market and have, who knows, 5 or 10 years more to go before this all ends. When I wrote that in March and published it in discussed it on the radio in March and published it on Bloomberg in April, a lot of people were, come on, you got to be kidding me. The market's down 30 plus percent. When has that ever happened before? And the answer is 1987. So when we talk about unprecedented activity, I would be a little hesitant before we declare the bull market over and we declare this to be a bubble. Once we get on the other side of lockdown and there's some sort of a treatment and or vaccine widely distributed, who knows, maybe earnings catch up to admittedly lofty stock prices. And I tend to think in terms of longer secular cycles, and so I kind of look at this as an externality, not a normal economic cycle.
Okay, great. And David, your thoughts?
Right. Well, look, what the world looks like when this crisis is truly over is anyone's guess. But I'll say with 100% clarity that it's going to look a lot different than it did before. And not just the question over government policy, which we discussed earlier, but at the individual level, months of isolation and continued distancing and then the ongoing fear of the pandemic are going to fundamentally alter lifestyles and I think have a profound influence, not just on the way we live, but on how we conduct ourselves in our personal and our commercial lives. So, for example, I would say that working from home is going to continue to be a much more dominant force, and that's going to have negative implications for some sectors like commercial real estate. But hugely positive secular implications for stuff like internet infrastructure, computer hardware, video conferencing. And I would say that at the same time, urban working and living is going to go through a profound shift and we're going to find a secular change, a much greater awareness coming out of this period of history, beyond just hygiene, but also a much greater appreciation for space. As in open space, which obviously is very good news for single-family home builders. There's going to be a sharp reduction in travel to work, travel in general, so nothing here that's very good for the travel industry or, as I said before, for the office real estate market. So I think that, look, any investment strategy preparing for the new normal is going to have to emphasize that work at home, remote lifestyle, 5G, cloud computing, is going to continue to favor big cap tech with the utility or essential characteristics. I'd rather pick these plays up at better prices, but there is a fundamental reason why these stocks have come to concentrate the market as much as they have. I think we have to become increasingly thematic and thoughtful in our decision making, much more so than normal, because the stock market, financial assets in general, and really have become nothing more than a casino with no more true price discovery or risk assessment because G. Powell is the dealer at the blackjack table handing out the chips for free. And this is why people like Leon Cooperman just a couple of months ago said that capitalism has gone on a semi-permanent sabbatical. A couple of other things to note. So I like the ideas of sectors that have strong balance sheets and utility-like characteristics. So that's something that I want to focus on. But I also want to talk about one of the key investment ideas for the current state of the world, which is gold, whether it's physical gold or the much greater leverage you get through the producers. I think it's a very good hedge against the instability that the extremes of deflation and inflation bring. I mean, if there is deflation, these interest rates will remain low, maybe go negative, and that makes the opportunity cost of holding gold basically nil. And then if we get the inflation, well, gold will do well as its classic store of value. I've been bullish on the gold and gold mining stocks for the past number of years, but in 2020, it really has become my highest conviction call. We have to recognize that gold is not a commodity. It's trading as a currency that is no government's liability. Its production growth annually runs pretty consistently at around 1%. Whereas, I said before, you look at the global production of money supply, global, not just U.S., is running around 20%. So that's the beautiful thing about gold, is that it is not a liability that a central bank can simply have forgiven. And it's not a currency that can simply be printed by government fiat. And let's keep in mind that we're back to $16 trillion of bonds globally trading with a negative yield. And you have 10-year JGBs and 10-year UK gilts that are now just basis points away from going below zero. And once they do, you'll be talking about $19 trillion of global bonds, or 30% of the world fixed income market trading at a negative yield. And that is why in a investment world where there's no such thing as a no-brainer, gold actually comes pretty close. And I'll say this too. It's why I also favor the treasury market. It's what I've called the bond bullion barbell, because I love acronyms. But remember that the long end of the treasury market is the highest yield out of any major industrial country and with the greatest liquidity attributes. So I'll just tell you right now, you know, people were saying to me at the end of last year, what idiot would buy a long U.S. Treasury with a 2.5% yield? And we can see today that it's the idiot who wanted a 25% total return. It was that idiot that wanted to buy the long bond at the end of last year, because most people can't do bond market math and realize the power of convexity at these low levels of interest rates, the interplay between price and yield. You're not buying a long bond for the yield. I love it when I hear people say, who would buy the long bond or the 10-year note at these levels? No, you're buying it for the price appreciation. That's what's dominating the total return. Most people don't even know that the 30-year treasury this year, because we're so fixated on the NASDAQ 100, nobody knows that the long bond has generated a 25% total return year to date with a fraction of the volatility and no capital risk. But I look at a 1.4% long bond in the United States, to me, is a bargain. When you look at it relative to gilts at 0.8, JGBs at 0.6, or German bonds at zero. So those are my investment philosophies for the next 12 months.
Great. And Ira, your thoughts?
Well, I can do bond math, and I was opposed to it, but the COVID helped smooth that way for bondholders. But as long as the world stays with severe negative real yields, I think David's gold play, and like that gold play, and I think that the threat of deflation is why I've stayed long gold, because it's a response from central banks, and they have not disappointed me, by the way, throughout this whole thing as to how far they'll go to prevent the any type of deflationary spiral. So I think that makes sense. And you look around the world, and I explain this to people, when you really look at the best currency today in terms of real yield, I have to say the yen. The yen is okay, it's at zero, because Japan has no inflation. They haven't had any inflation, and they did have deflation at one time. But their interest rates are effectively zero. Inflation rate is effectively zero. Therefore, the real yield is zero. Where the U.S., yes, David's right, if I go out on the curve far enough, I can get to zero. So if I buy a 30-year treasury, but I might run, if I'm a foreigner, I actually might run some currency risk then. And the hedging mechanism gets a little bit expensive with these low yields. Well, in discussing where Barry goes in 1987, you know, when the stock market broke in 1987, real yields were probably 2.5 to 3%. We're in a world now that's so vastly different. And that's why that's why the market could recover so quickly, because we were in a true capitalistic growth spurt, and you had to put in, and money was really paid for. And what pushed the yields higher and higher, of course, was that Germany broke the Louvre Accord, because they weren't supposed to raise rates, and that's what created so many of the problems in Japan, because Japan stayed true to the agreement that was made for the Louvre Accord. But all that being said, we are in a world where negative real yields are really creating all types of investment uncertainty, not for today and not for tomorrow, because I think that's what continues to power on the equity market. So Barry Reynolds is fully invested, and I say that's exactly right. You know, just pick, but I think it's a stock picker's market rather than just buying baskets of things and hope that 70% perform okay and 10% perform great and 20% may lose money. But I think if you pick right here, you will find, in response to David, and I think David actually said this, or somebody wrote it, it may have been Ed Yardini, when the world is really upside down, when you're buying bonds for capital appreciation, and you're buying equities for yield. And that's the world in which we find ourselves. And until we see that the central banks have some exit strategy, you know, party on, because where are you going? As long as they're going to keep real yields so negative, it makes a lot of different asset classes very desirable.
Well, this is great insight and discussion, gentlemen. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Barry?
You could go to Ritholtz.com and see my daily commentary, or follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. If you want to learn more about our investment process, that would be RitholtzWealth.com. Masters in Business is published and broadcast on Bloomberg Radio every weekend. And that's pretty much it. I'm not too hard to find.
Great. And David, if you can mention also, there's a trial that can be got on a free 30-day trial to Rosenberg Research. David?
That's right. So please, I'm inviting you to the Rosenberg Research website. Just Google Rosenberg Research, and feel free to come on and register. We have a variety of services and products. I still write my daily Breakfast with Dave, but we also do special reports and podcasts and chart packages, technicals, fundamentals. It's really a one-stop shop for economics and financial market strategy. We have a one-month free trial, so come kick the tires. If you want to email me directly, it's pretty easy. It's Rosenberg at RosenbergResearch.com, and would love to have you, as I said, kick our tires and hopefully become a subscriber.
Great. And Ira?
I keep hoping I'm going to get back to the blog, Notes from Underground. I get so many emails. When are you coming back? I'm hoping to do that, but You know, I'm in a lot of different chat rooms during the day. And again, you have to, for me, I can think like an investor, but my world is a trading world. So there's a lot of trading rooms where I appear during the day where we can discuss things from a much more trading perspective than investment horizon, so to speak, like yesterday's FOMC minutes provided great trading opportunities. So I'm there, but my beloved is Notes from Underground, and hopefully I will be restarting my engines. Barry and David, this sheltering in place because of my age and what my grandchildren desire has really crimped me, and I am getting a little crazy at times. So I love these podcasts, and I love for the opportunity. I mean, to sit here and talk with really two of my all-time favorites over the years, Barry Ritholtz and David Rosenberg. Really,
so kind
a great opportunity, and I appreciate that.
Awesome. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.